I think that's the nicest compliment we could pay on that music. We weren't sure if we were supposed to clap or not. That's pretty cool. Yeah. That was very sacred. Thanks. Well, normally at this point, the person giving the message comes right up, but instead I'm going to introduce Michael Moran. Michael and I have known each other, not real well, but we've known each other off and on for the last 35 years, and I've always really enjoyed him. I'm going to tell you two very short little stories about Michael. The first one is, I think I'd been coming here for a year or two, and then Michael and his wife Faith joined the church, and he likes to get involved in things. And so there was one Sunday, well, we didn't really know him, but one Sunday he went up to make an announcement about something, I don't remember what. And Michael had made his living at KXLY and KHQ for 20 years. And so we're all sitting out there starting to listen to this guy that nobody knows, and he starts speaking, and he's got this radio voice, announcer voice, and I would go, oh God, who's that? So that was the first thing. That was my first experience of Michael. Second, as many of you know, about 4 years ago, I had the chance to lead a church down in Oroville, California. That's the first time I had led a church, so I thought, I think I'll call the 20 biggest churches in Unity and see what is it you do? How'd you get so big? So I called Unity Village and said, well, what are the 20 biggest churches in the Unity movement? And they said, I don't know. And they said, and this is true, they go, but if you find out, would you tell us? So I did a bunch of digging and a bunch of calling and all that. And it turned out that Michael had founded a church down in Sacramento. I mean, founded it, pioneered it. And it was the 10th largest church in the Unity movement. I mean, I thought that was pretty cool. And so I called him and said, so what'd you do right? I mean, how come you're the 10th biggest? And he's a humble guy, and so he goes, we're the 10th biggest? I didn't know that. I said, yeah, you are. He said, well, I'll bring it up in our staff meeting. And so he brought it up in his staff meeting, and he gave me a call back. He was only one of two or three ministers that did. And he called back and said, well, we talked about it, and it was we have a lot of groups meet there, and we really focus on prayer. I thought that was interesting. It's interesting because, to me, those two stories symbolize Michael Moran, which is, lots of talents and skills like the radio and like growing a church. But the other thing that I really like about Michael Moran, and the older I get, the more importance I place on this, he's a nice, nice, nice man. Thanks.
Wow. What a nice introduction. Thank you. Let me hand you this. Good morning, everyone. I love this place. I love this place. And I'll tell you why, because this is where it all started for me. And I've spoken here before on occasion, and I kind of tell the same story, so I apologize for that. But every time I walk in, I remember the moment I came here for the first time. And, you know, in Unity, we talk about we're here by divine appointment. And I knew that I was here by divine appointment. And this was the first non-Catholic church I ever willingly stepped foot in. You know, and even it wasn't really willing, my mother tricked me into coming here. I was actually a broadcaster in Seattle for most of the time, but whenever I would come over here, Mom, whose best friend, lived next door, and she was a Unity person. Her name was Edna Ganser. And whenever Edna, we'd get in these philosophical discussions, she goes, you know what? And I was done with religion. She says, you ought to go to Unity. They think just like you do. And I said, Edna, I'm done with organized religion. She says, well, we're not very organized. I knew I was in the right place. And I want the least organized religion there is. By the way, I want to thank you for that song, Open My Mind, Open My Ears. That is exactly why I am back in this area now. I was, Dennis said, my late wife and I founded Spiritual Life Center in 1998. She died in 2008, and I retired 3 years ago. And I knew I had to leave Sacramento. I had to get out of the story of us and Spiritual Life Center. I could not get out of that story. It was so ingrained in people. And so I lead tours to Ireland called the Magical Mystical Tours. And last year, I was by the Hill of Tara. They've just uncovered an ancient well there. And I'd been there many times, but I'd never known about this well. And so I went to that well, and I knelt at the well, and I looked in, and the water, well, I didn't know there was any water in there because it looked like there was just some wetness down at the bottom. And I was disappointed. And I thought, oh, well, you know. But so I was going to put my hand down just to touch the wetness. The water was so clear that as soon as I went right into water, into this ice-cold water, and I was praying to the goddess of the well because there was something was trying to come through. I knew I had to leave, but I didn't know how, I didn't know where, didn't know when. And I took that water and I put it on my head and I said, open the mind of my mind, the eyes of my eyes, the ears of my ears, and the heart of my heart. What's next for me? And I got this very clear vision of a hand pointing like this, and then this voice, I call it the voice, but I don't know whether it's a knowing, I experience it like I hear it, but it said, it is time for you to put a period on Sacramento. No more commas. Because I was always going to leave when, I'm going to leave, there was always some kind of condition. It said, period. I knew I was supposed to leave. And so the guidance then, I was pulled by a vision back to this area where I grew up. And I love it here. It feels good to be home again. You know how Spirit keeps placing before you what's going to prepare you for what's next or whatever the guidance you need, and it just keeps showing up. And for me, it's a poem by Rumi, the 13th century Sufi mystic poet. By the way, did you know that Rumi is the best-selling poet in the United States today? Yeah, wow, is right. Thousands and thousands of poems, and all of the poets in the world, he is the best-selling poet in the United States. But this is the poem that keeps showing up for me. It's called The Guest House. This human being is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexplained visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be cleaning you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Oof. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whomever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. You know, in the book of James, it says, count it all good, brothers and sisters. Whatever comes down your road, call it good because it is from God. It's easier said than done sometimes, isn't it? How many of you know Mary O'Malley or know of Mary O'Malley? She's a wonderful teacher. She lives over in the Seattle area. I've known her for 40 years, and she's just one of the most authentic people I know, very real, very transparent. But she wrote a book called What's in the Way is the Way. What's in the Way is the Way. And in this book, Mary focuses on moving beyond our struggles and our fears. And you know what? We all have struggles and fears. It's part of the human package. But we don't have to let them rule us. You know, Jesus had them, Buddha had them, we all have them. I have mine and you have yours. But we don't have to follow them. With spiritual practice, that we things like we learn here, affirmations, visualizations, prayers, meditation, we can turn our struggles and our fears into spiritual gold, 24-karat gold. You've done it many times in your life, or you wouldn't be here. You know, at the River Jordan, Jesus, when he was baptized by John the Baptist, of course, we look at the Bible metaphorically, metaphysically, and really represents is not the washing away of sins or anything like that, but what it meant was that here is where he had his realization that he was loved by God, that God loved him no matter what. This is my son in whom I am well pleased. It was an awakening that he had. Now, if we really had that awakening, you'd think we'd, you know, do a little happy dance and want to go out and share the gospel with everyone. But that's not what happened. Because the next line says, after he has this awakening, the next line says, and he was led by the Spirit of truth into the wilderness, which is confusion, blankness, barrenness. Led by the Spirit of truth into the wilderness to be tempted by Satan. Push pause. In unity, we don't believe Satan, the devil, is a force that's outside of us. We believe that Satan or the devil is, it's our fears. It's that small part of us that our inadequacies, our fears that keep us locked up and imprisoned. So Jesus goes into the wilderness and he's tempted by Satan. And what does he do? Get behind me. Get behind me. Every time one of his fears would come up, get behind me. You follow me. I don't follow you. It's a great example of what we're asked to do. Not be led by the fear, led by the sense of inadequacy, but to say, get behind me. I don't follow you. Fear, it's what keeps us small if we refuse to face them, even name them. And fear is man's and woman's only adversary. But again, fear doesn't have to shut us down. It can wake us up. When we are afraid, we do fearful things. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, John Lennon and a lot of other people have said there's only two motivating forces for human beings, fear or love. When we are in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, with excitement, and with acceptance. We need to learn to love ourselves first, and that's the most difficult, because we have to learn to live all of our glorious self and all of our imperfections as well, to love the whole package. I've told this story before. When I was a teen here in Spokane, I was what they would have classified as a troubled teen. I went through a very, very dark period. And I was traumatized at 12 years old. I had just turned 12, and my father dropped dead in front of me, and I couldn't save him. And so I went from being this, you know, nice little altar boy kid to Rosemary's Baby overnight, it seemed like. You know, it was like the perfect storm. I was 12 years old. My hormones were thrown in the blender. Somebody hit it on high. And I went out of control. I was terrified of life. I felt abandoned. I felt trapped. And so I started getting in a lot of trouble. I was kicked out of school. My mother was a teacher in town, you know. She was now a widow. And I always joke that, you know, other parents had, you know, my son is an A student at so-and-so, or on the honor roll. My mother's bumper sticker said, my son was inmate of the month at the Spokane Juvenile Authority. But I went into rebellion. Today, we would have called it post-traumatic stress syndrome, but there was no name for it back then. But I found myself one night, fear was ruling me, and I found myself in jail. It wasn't the first time I was there, at the Spokane Juvenile Detention Center, and I was miserable. I was beaten, I was bloody, I was swollen, I was embarrassed, so embarrassed. And I looked around that cell. I'd been there before, not in that particular cell, but I looked around this environment that I was in, and the thought came to me, a crystal clear thought, this is your life. This is your life unless you change how you do life now. And then the thought came, nobody did this to you. There's no one to blame. You did this to you. Every thought, every choice you've made brought you back to this place and will continue to do that. This is your life unless you change now. I heard that. Life had perfectly placed me where I needed to be so that I could really hear that still, small voice. I just returned from Oxfordshire, England, where I was part of a gathering of spiritual leaders from around the world, and we came together for 6 days, four of which were in total silence, 24 hours a day, as a group. It was powerful. It was so powerful. And then when I came out of that, and I, you know, drove to London, then got the tube to go to Heathrow, and then all with all the security, the heightened security, the world just seemed to be really shaky after that total silence in the estate where Lewis Carroll wrote the Alice series. You know, it was a magical place. So life had placed me where I could hear that voice very clearly, and I could see how fear had ruled me to that point. And I was so insecure and so inadequate and so awkward as a teen. I didn't know a way out. But I asked in that cell, how can I change this? And I was given a crystal clear vision of me as a young broadcaster, what we used to call a disc jockey, as a disc jockey who was using his program not just to play records, but for the benefit of others. Now, you have no idea how that was a grand canyon away from how I felt about myself, ever seeing myself speaking in front of a group of people and helping people. And then this voice that I call the voice said, you will be a voice for the voiceless. I didn't even know what that meant because I was so shy and awkward. I didn't feel like I had a voice. And besides that, nobody was listening. But what that image did for me, it awakened in me a curiosity to how can I become that from here? Mary O'Malley wrote, curiosity is the ability to bring your attention and your immediate experience together. As your attention becomes engaged with what is happening right now, you will discover that there is a whole lot going on around you that you never noticed. It is life. And I'll tell you, it took a lot of pain and a lot of struggle and a lot of humiliation to drive me to the depths of life where I finally could hear, see clearly, hear clearly, and ask the question, how can I become that picture instead of this picture? How can I change? And over the years, and it took years, all that bad stuff turned to good stuff or God stuff. Once I sat with the fear and acknowledged it and gave it a name, or names in this case, accepted responsibility, unleashed my curiosity as to how could this be different? What would it take? How can I transform this? You see, I was addicted to fear. And I would say most of the world today is addicted to fear. It is sold as a commodity. And the more, you know, what do you say? Thoughts held in mind produce after their kind. We saw another perfect example of that this morning, that what fear can do, the depths that we can descend, that fear will drive us into. You know, if fear is something that we have to acknowledge, but we need to put it in its place. Curiosity is the key to all of this. You know, I was addicted to fear, and I was addicted to the belief that the world was not safe, that it was big and scary, and it bruised you, and it abandoned you over and over again. I believed that. And you know, as Jesus said, according to your belief, it will be done unto you. It doesn't have to be a good belief, a positive belief, a productive belief. It's whatever your belief it is, that's going to be your experience of life. Curiosity is about being in the questions, how can this be different? Why? Where? When? You know, in this open and vulnerable state of mind, I ask, why am I here again? Why? Because of the choices that you made again. You know, based on your belief system that life is not fair and it's scary. And the more you keep believing that, the more you're going to find yourself here. How can I change this? How can I change from this to that image that was so clearly given me by changing the ways that you're doing life, by finding new friends to hang around with, productive friends, by going to school maybe. That's a good place to start. By becoming the person you saw in that vision that you have just been given. Where do I start? Right here in this cell. When? Now. Right now, start changing your thoughts. Say yes to this new image. You know, I left that cell for the last time a totally changed person. And the worst day of my life at that point became the first day of the best days of my life to follow. I remember when I was asked to speak before teenagers, and I'm very nervous around teenagers because my teenage years were awful, you know, and they just remind me of that. So I agreed because it was a friend of mine, it was his group, and I said, okay. And he said, but you have to answer their questions honestly. And I said, all right. So this one kid, it was really fun. Again, it was one of my fears, and it turned into be a great blessing. But this one kid said, in your high school years, what was the best day of your high school years, and what was the worst day? And I said, the same day. The same day. The worst day turned out to be the best day of the rest of my life. But here's what life will do. You know, once we say yes to this new image, we start to make a U-turn. We start to make a U-turn in the way that we approach life. One of my favorite stories in the Bible is the prodigal son. You know, here we had this image of God in the Old Testament, you know, the old codger God, you know, who had his two kids in the Garden of Eden, and he was, you know, like the old man in the garden, get off my grass, get out of the house and don't come back. You know, and that's the God that we grew up with. And then Jesus presents this new father image of this God that has these two sons, and they're very wealthy, and the kid, you know, being a little teenager and goes and says, I want it now. I want immediate gratification. Give me it all now. And so the father, being God, you know, gives it to him. And the kid, this little Jewish kid, goes off, and he squanders the fortune on wine, women, and wild living, and God knows what else he did with that money. But he finds himself, here's a Jewish kid, he finds himself working for a Gentile tending to his pigs. He's neck deep in pig poop. Jewish kid. Not a good place to find yourself. You can't, what the story's trying to tell us, you can't get lower than this and be a Jewish kid. But that's where he is in life. He was in his own hell, in his own cell. And then it says, he starts thinking, God, how did I get here again? How did I sink this low? And how can I get out? He started asking, got it curious. How can I get out? He gets an image. Go home to your father. Go home even if you can just be a servant. Oh, no, that'll never happen. I've sinned before God. I've sinned before my father. And the voice keeps saying, go home to your father and ask. So he starts rehearsing his speech. And he starts slowly, you know, brushing himself off and going home, rehearsing, Father, I've sinned before you and for God. And then the story tells us that God, his father, every day since he's been gone, has been scanning the horizon looking for the return of his son. And one day, he sees his son on the horizon. And this new image that Jesus is planting in our mind of God, you know, is not the old codger with his arms like this, come on, crawl to me. Instead, the image that is given is this God force, this power, rushes to meet him. Rushes to meet him. And I see him crying out of tears of joy. Approaches the boy, and the kid goes, Father, I've sinned before you, and I've sinned before God. No, 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 no. Don't even say it. Once you were lost, now you're found. Yes, but Father, I have sinned before you. No, no, no. Once you were blind, now you can see. And he takes off his cloak, and he puts it on him, puts on new shoes, kills a calf, has a barbecue. You know, all's well. Unconditional love. No condition in this at all. What a beautiful image that we are given of this new force that doesn't leave anybody out and never, ever, ever gives up on us or on life. Life will always maneuver us Even if it's into neck deep in pig poop or it's jail or whatever it takes, any situation we need to see the spells that we have taken on and incorporated into our belief systems. So what are the areas in your life where there's some discomfort, some stuckness, where you feel like, God, here I am again. Where are you stuck? Where's the ground shaky in your life? Finances, health, relationships, what is it? I'm going to shift a little bit here. Last week, the world lost an icon, a perfectly imperfect man who declared himself the greatest. The greatest. I am the greatest. And then he went on to prove it. A young black kid from Louisville, Kentucky, who received a vision at a very early age that pulled him. He was pulled by that vision that he was going to be the champion of the world, Muhammad Ali. And then he did it 3 times. What a storied life. You know, we first get introduced to this brash, fast-talking, good-looking, ain't I pretty, you know, braggadocious super athlete at the Olympics in 1960. And he was charismatic. And you either loved him or you hated him. And I did both at different times. You know, he was not going to accept anything less than that the white world expected for themselves and yet withheld from his black world. He represented a threat to a belief system that was very flawed, very old, and very dark. He shook up the status quo, and he got bolder and bolder and louder and louder. And he took on everyone, systems and people. He rejected his Baptist Christian upbringing because the white Christians rejected him and his race, wouldn't eat with him, wouldn't worship with him. He embraced the Nation of Islam and its leader, Elijah Muhammad, which really, really put him at odds with the white world and many in his own race. But he then left that form of Islam and moved into Sunni, which is a more moderate. And then later again, Muhammad Ali moved more into the mystical aspect of Islam, Sufism. Ali was always curious. No matter where he was, how can I do this better? How can I change this? He was always asking those questions, why, where, how, when. He took on the United States government over the Vietnam War. He refused the draft, and he lost it all. This is what he said. What can you give me, America, for turning down my religion? You want me to go where the white man says and go fight a war against some people I know nothing about, get some freedom for other people, when my own people right here can't get theirs? He says, nobody in Vietnam ever called me nigger, but the country that wants to send me there, that's what they call me. He refused, and it cost him 3.5 years of the best years of his life, his boxing years, tens of millions of dollars. He was willing to give it all up, and he did. And he stood firm on his principles and his inner convictions as the world was shaking around him. He did the right thing because it was the right thing. Martin Luther King said, it's always the right time to do the right thing, but you must be prepared to accept the consequences. And he did. It was overturned, but he still lost that 3.5 years. He was vilified for much of his life, and later adored and respected like few others in our modern history have been for his activism for peace and racial equality and for his humanitarianism. This 3-time world champion used his notoriety and that platform to bring awareness to the huge destructive issues facing our nation and our world. Racism, the war in Vietnam, and later, in the later years of his life, how to accept life with dignity. When he was hit with Parkinson's disease, God, was there ever a more dignified man, the way that he approached that? You know, Ali was very generous, and he loved people, especially children, and he was lavish with his love and with his fortune when it came to disadvantaged children. He helped people believe in their own possibilities and in the greatness, the possible greatness for all people and life. And Ali, with all of his imperfections, and they were legion, he would be the first to admit it, reinforced the importance of believing in something that is greater than ourselves and standing up for that belief no matter what the cost. You know, he shook up the world around us, and he stood firm in his beliefs. And time again, he turned adversity and failure into pure gold. He never lost sight of the greatness in himself and the goodness in the world. His curiosity kept him going. Knock him down, he gets back up. Knock him down again, he gets right back up. Take away his title, he gets it back three times. Take away his freedom, he gets even freer. Take away his health and his ability to speak, his good looks, his ability to float like a butterfly, and he becomes a symbol of grace and dignity and beauty. Remember when he stood there trembling at the Olympics to light the torch? I wept. I mean, here was this man that did float like a butterfly. Nobody had moves like Muhammad Ali. And here's this hero standing on that platform, his hands shaking, you know, and we're all going, come on, Ali, you got one more in you. You can do this. Come on, Muhammad, you can do this. And eventually, he finally got over there, and he lit that torch, and the world cheered for its champion. Wow. CNN, last Friday, aired the interfaith service. Did anybody see that? Ali's, wow. He planned this himself before he died, because even in death, Muhammad Ali brought people of diverse faiths and religions and cultures together in celebration. He showed us what life could be like, that we really can, as races and cultures and religions and governments, play nice together, that we can really get along. And there, as his speakers and the people performing were Buddhist chants, there was a Rabbi Michael Lerner, Native American chanting and speaking. People of every race, culture, creed were all there standing with this man and what he stood for. And when asked how he would like to be remembered as he negotiated that shaky ground most of his life with such grace, he said, I would like to be remembered as a man who won the heavyweight championship three times, who was humorous and who treated everyone right, as a man who never looked down on those who looked up to him and who helped as many people as possible. I'd like to be remembered as a man who stood up for his beliefs no matter what, a man who tried to unite humankind through faith and kindness and love. I guess I'd settle for being remembered only as a great boxer who became a leader and a champion for his people. And I wouldn't even mind if folks forgot how pretty I was. You know, I had planned a very different talk today, standing firm on shaky ground. And as I was watching the videos of Muhammad Ali's life, and I was making notes, you know, just thoughts, and they showed the video of him at the Olympics, shaking. And I went, oh my God, that's the talk. That's the talk. That's what standing firm on shaky ground looks like. That's what it looks like. That's how it shows up. You know, he really showed us the way. He dealt with his disease, with his setbacks, with such grace and such dignity, and he never said, well, he said no a lot. But what he always said yes to was the greatness in people, in himself, in God. What an example of how it looks and what it takes to stand firm on shaky ground. It takes courage in the face of fear. To do, like Emmett Fox said, do it trembling if you must, but you must do it. Do it trembling if you must, but you must do it. Two, it takes conviction. To do what is right for you because it is right. And be prepared to accept the consequences. Acceptance. of what it is and what it's going to cost, and curiosity to never stop asking, how can I do this better? How can I be a better person? What will it take? And number five is faith. Faith in God, in the power of God in us, and in the innate goodness of people and life. Muhammad Ali, for me, you know, as a young boy growing up, and growing up with him, was a model of a life that was fully lived, no matter what. The Buddhist teacher Jack Kornfield said, at the end of life, you will only be asked two questions. That's it, two questions. Question one, did you live your life fully? And question two, did you love lavishly? I think Muhammad Ali can easily answer yes to both of those. He lived his life fully, and man, did he love lavishly. Godspeed on your journey, Muhammad Ali, for showing us all how to stand firm on shaky ground. Thank you all for letting me be here this morning. God bless you.